Thursday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast, finishing up the 15 and 60. Also got some news to get to as well. We are sponsored today by Coca-Cola and Powerade. Danny, we have hit the big time in terms of our sponsors. Also sponsored today by SeatGeek. Use that cat space code to get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Let's get started here with a little bit of news. The biggest of which is that Dwayne Wade suffered a nasty elbow injury last night against the Grizzlies. The Bulls lost. He is now out for the year with a small fracture in that elbow and an elbow sprain.
It's complicated because it also affects his pending potential free agency. He has a, I think it's about $23 million player option for next year, which this affects somehow, but I'm not exactly sure how, because I think the bidders for him won't really be affected by this. I don't think this is going to be an injury that really lingers, but he does have to think about the security that's involved.
Yeah, I think it actually, if anything, is going to help him, because if the Bulls don't make the playoffs or implode, that stink isn't on him as much now. And also, just as he's getting older, the likelihood is that his performance, especially at the end of the year, would continue to decline. So now the facade of Dwayne Wade from years past is still more intact than it would be with another 20 games or so. But I agree with you. I don't know that it'll have a significant impact. How about, though, on the Bulls going forward this season?
This always ties back to the idea of replacements, and I don't know exactly who's gonna fit in with those 30 minutes or so, but the most logical combination would be some of Paul Zipser and some of Denzel Valentine, and that's a pretty significant downgrade in terms of talent. I mean, it's great for the Bulls to be able to see what those guys have. It's a very important part of their evaluation going into the summer, but in terms of winning games this year, that's significant.
Some would say, and David Locke actually tweeted to this effect, that he's been one of the most inefficient players in the league, actually a higher usage than Jimmy Butler. You know, like 51% true shooting, really below average. It doesn't shoot any threes, shooting it really poorly. Remember when he made like five threes in a row at the beginning of the season? Everyone's like, oh, it's going to be different this year. He's going to take threes. Yeah, that didn't happen. Shockingly enough, his entire career was more significant in terms of that. But nonetheless, yeah, I think that when Butler is on the floor, you can probably make the argument that they actually might be better without Wade, especially considering his inconsistent defensive effort. But then when Butler goes out of the game, they've already been getting killed without Butler. I think they have about a negative 10 net rating this year without Butler. Some of that compiled without Wade. He's missed some games on the back end of back-to-backs and stuff. But, and they just have absolutely nobody on this team who can create anything off the dribble outside of Dwayne Wade when Butler is off the floor. I think probably what they'd have to do is just go back to Michael Carter-Williams more as the backup point guard. And he actually played against Memphis because, you know, it was three games went by and Fred Hoiberg had to change up his rotation. But Carter Williams at least can create a little bit of something, get into the post against smaller guards, run a pick and roll, have some chance of getting into the lane and doing something. I mean, he's really the only other guy on the roster who can do that at this point. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's just going to get uglier when Butler is out of the game. They might play a little bit better when Butler is in the game.
That's certainly fair. We could move on to another guy who was shut down for the season, Eric Bledsoe. And the Suns played a fascinating game against the Kings last night. Scal went crazy. And the young Suns actually looked pretty good. Tyler Ulis.
Was Scal 32-17?
I think so. And most of that was in the fourth quarter, which is ludicrous.
Yeah, he had 21. He had 21 in the fourth quarter, right? Unbelievable.
It was spectacular. That will probably be at least part of the subject of our next Kings 15 and 60 will be Scaller that game. But anyway, back to the Suns. Bledsoe was out for the year, and this also led to the super weird story that came out this morning, we're recording this on Thursday, of Brandon Knight basically going, no, I have back spasms, I'm not going to play.
I'm not sure that report is 100% reliable. That's from John sure. Gambadoro, who I know talks to people in the organization. He's a Phoenix area radio host. And also, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, Knight's probably... It's a little ornery, and he's probably pretty pissed off that he basically has been deactivated for the rest of the year. Let's start with Bledsoe first, though. Did he play last night in that game?
Brandon Knight?
No, Bledsoe.
Sorry, Bledsoe. No, he did not.
Okay, so yeah, Ulis got the start and was okay. So yeah, I mean, they're definitely going to find out what they got with Ulis. Too bad that Dragan Bender, maybe he'll be back before the end of the year, but probably not, isn't around to maybe get a few more reps with the ball in his hands as well. But, you know, TJ Warren, Devin Booker, they'll probably get more of all they can eat at this point, as will Ulis. But for Bledsoe, I mean, it was said he's dealing with recurring knee soreness. That may be the case, We know that he's had surgery on both knees and had that meniscus repair, has really gone through this year and played well without incident. And it makes sense because they should probably be trying to trade him in the offseason this year, number one, so you don't want him to get hurt again. And of course, it helps the tank to roll on. As for Knight, I mean, yeah, all right, I understand he was pissed off. He just didn't want to play. He probably also, it wouldn't shock me if he weren't keeping himself in great shape either once, you know, things kind of got shut down and he still has 3 years left on that $70 million contract. But if he wants to get out of there, he needs to get back in there and play. That's his best way, is to actually look okay and convince a team that misses out on a free agent point guard this summer to actually trade for him.
Agreed, because there will be teams that need point guards, but if they look at Knight's production and his contract and go, well, why are we going to do that? Especially if they see him as a negative asset, which is possible. It really depends on how teams evaluate him at this point. But the more teams see you positively, the easier it is for your current team to get out of you. And I don't think the Suns are sitting there going, oh man, next year if we trade Eric Bledsoe, we're going to give Knight the starting job enthusiastically.
No. It would appear that will not be. I'm sure that they are very much will be considering drafting one of these really good point guards, depending on where they end up. Let's hit a couple of these quickly. Kevin Love expected to return on this upcoming road trip. Great news for the Cavaliers. They will have time to reintegrate him. Again, he had that 4 to 6 weeks meniscus trim done. We'll see how he looks when he gets back, whether he's able to return, doesn't experience any further complications. We'll see about that. In other great news, LaMarcus Aldridge was able to return after only a 2-game absence last night, although the Spurs did lose to the Blazers, but he was able to play his normal minutes, looked fine, so that was a scare, and glad to see that it wasn't anything major for him. What else we got?
Timofey Mozgov looks like he's going to be shut down. Mark Spears had that, and then I believe Ramona Shelburne had that. Waldang is shut down as well.
Yeah, and this is just the tank continuing to roll on for the Lakers. As disappointing a season as Dang, and to a lesser extent Mozgov, I thought Mozgov actually hasn't been that bad for them this year, have been this season. They are still better than these players who are playing now. I mean, they've got David Nwaba out of the D League, who's an athletic guy. I mean, I don't fault signing him, but he's basically been in the starting lineup immediately now. Mozgov, for all his faults, is probably still a better player. Certainly still a rotation player in the NBA. I don't know. Zubac is probably a better offensive player than him at this point, but Mozgov probably better defensively. And same thing maybe even with respect to Tarik Black. But this is just the Lakers tank getting rolling. This is why protected picks should only be allowed in the lottery or nothing, just to... because otherwise you just have teams going for these specific positions, and the Lakers have really been doing that for over a month now. Also pretty hilarious because Jeannie Buss was on record a couple of years ago saying that, like, no way can we ever tank, that ruins your culture, blah blah blah. Okay, Jeannie. And it's not her fault. People respond to the incentives that the league allows. Like, this is the NBA's fault that this happens, and so many teams are doing this, really. And again, this is an extreme example where they're trying to, because they have that top three pick. Plenty of teams, I mean, baseball teams, for example, like, they go to 40-man rosters in September, and if they're out of contention, they bring in all these minor leaguers. Like, you know, and for a long time, the baseball draft and draft position wasn't considered important at all. So with that being the case, it would make sense to do this even without the draft pick incentive. I mean, and you saw, for example, even the Nets shut down Brooke Lopez and Thad Young for the last 5 games last year, and they, of course, had no draft incentive as well. They just wanted to protect those guys from getting injured so they could trade them. And then they did trade Thaddeus Young in a good trade. They got them Caris LeVert and a second round pick.
And that might be a part of the Bledsoe one as well. Yeah. Like, Bledsoe, that's less true for Mozgov and Deng considering, but for Bledsoe, I mean, his injury concerns make it that if he had something else, it would be a much different thing. So might as well shut him down when there's no real incentive to play him.
Jordan Crawford bypassing a second 10-day contract. He has been outstanding with New Orleans, who desperately needed some shot creation, somebody who can do something on the wing. And he's agreed to a 2-year deal that likely includes this year and next year, rest of season and then next year. They could not offer him a longer contract than that. They didn't have an exception available to do that with. It's possible they maybe gave him a little bit of their room mid-level. We'll have to see how much of that is guaranteed, what the guaranteed dates are. I'm sure that'll come out in the next few days. All right, let's take a quick break and we'll be back with there were a couple other things actually before we do that. If you want to say those, Danny.
Well, Nicola Batum is probably the big one. So So he had that CT scan because of his migraines, and fortunately it came back negative. Chris Haynes had that. And then also Hollis Thompson is again a free agent. It's really disappointing because he's bounced around. He got cut from the Sixers and, you know, thought maybe somebody would pick him up off waivers. Nobody picked him up off waivers. Then he's been on the Pelicans, and the Pelicans went, nah, we're good.
Well, there's always a wonder of like, hey, this guy's shooting 40% on threes. Maybe he's actually like a good player in a normal ecosystem. And he certainly played with some good players, got some open shots, just was not able to convert on his three pointers. But I think the other problem with him is just that he's not very athletic. And, you know, the idea of him being 3-and-D, I don't think the D part of that really works out that much either. So maybe he'll get another shot. I'm sure he'll be in summer league with some team. But I think perhaps the scouting evaluation on him not being that good is looking like it might have been right. And of course the Sixers moved on from him, and now it appears the Pelicans will as well. All right, now let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with the 15 and 60 right after this. So I used to really enjoy college basketball and the NCAA tournament, but now that my job is following the NBA in as excruciating a detail as possible, I'm at a bit of a loss when filling out my bracket. Fortunately, there are tons of NCAA March Madness tips available at coke.com/always ready. The site has a ton of stats and pointers that you don't really think about when you're filling out your bracket. So if you want to head over to your local Walmart and pick up some game time refreshments, maybe a 6-pack of Coca-Cola. I'm partial to Sprite personally, since I was a little kid, and an 8-pack of Powerade to rehydrate after you play a little bit of pickup yourself. You can also get a ton of info to help improve your bracket and hopefully put your friends to shame. When you pick up Coca-Cola and Powerade at Walmart, you'll always be ready for tip-off. So head over to Walmart and gear up to watch all the games with Coca-Cola and Powerade. Get in on the March Madness action by visiting coke.com/always ready. That's coke.com/always ready. Okay, let's get started here with the Indiana Pacers.
The Pacers are 35-33, 6-7 since the last time we did this, and they're an even 15th in offense, 15th in defense, negative 0.5 net rating, so about flat there too. But with all that, 538 gives them an 81% chance of making the playoffs, and they're projected to be 6th in the East after their win yesterday, and so they're projected to be 42. And what I thought was amusing, this will come up with another team, was I compile all the percentage data when we do the first episode. Their odds of making the playoffs went up 10% just on Wednesday because they beat the Hornets, and then so that means the Hornets lost too, and the Bulls lost, so that was a huge jump for them.
Well, not only that, but this Wade news, I think, will probably help them as well. So with the Bulls, perhaps less likely. Yeah. I mean, we talked about that.
It's basically nine teams for 8 spots now for me. Like, you know, it's the Bucks.
You're writing the Bulls off completely.
I'm not writing them off, but I think it's, I think I'll wait for them to sell me back in, as opposed to, you know, the other way around. But sure, you never know who's going to go undefeated.
Yeah. So it's really interesting. You noted they have the median offense and defense. I guess you can't have a median when there's 30 teams, but you know what I mean. They've at least improved that defense. They were so awful at the beginning of the year there. And the offense has, in fact, improved from last year when they're really among the worst teams in the league. Having Miles Turner, a full season of him at center, he's one of the better offensive centers with his shooting, has really helped that a lot, I think. But they were, of course, a great defense last year, and then they lost George Hill and Vogel and Mahinmi, and they've gotten a lot worse there. I think they're like the number 4 defense last year. I would say, though, this is an interesting question, but off the top of my head, their season has been the most similar to what I'd expect, both in terms of their overall performance and the performance of their individual players, than maybe any team.
I expected Paul George to be a little bit better, but other than that, yeah, I think it's about right. I mean, early on, there was that whole thing about Jeff Teague being bad, but he eventually got to the level I think we all expected.
He's been totally fine. He's been the same guy, really.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with you, but yeah.
It's... Miles Turner is taking a nice leap. Thad Young has been effective.
Well, I think our expectations of Al Jefferson were a little bit lower, and he's meeting those expectations, but that aligns with what you're saying.
Yeah, we thought their bench wouldn't be that good. Monte has taken another step back. Everyone's kind of just what you expect from them happen. I'm trying to think of who else has really been right about what we would have expected. I think the Hawks are pretty close in terms of what I expected going in. Maybe a little bit even worse.
What about the Lakers? I mean, really?
Well, but the 10-10 start, I think, and the fact they've almost been like a caricature of what you could have expected. They've yo-yoed so much.
I would say the Suns also align with that, where You know, like their Bledsoe is good, but not good enough to propel their team. Still can't figure out what's going on with their centers. Chris is maddening, but good at times. Those sorts of things. I think they're pretty much aligned too.
Yeah, they've been right around expectations. Yeah, that's really, I think those are really the two that I would look at as being closest. I mean, all these other teams have kind of had some injuries that have really derailed things. The Pacers have been incredibly healthy all year, actually. That's one thing that we could look at. And same thing with the Hawks, too. The Hawks have been very healthy all year. So I think that when a team plays close to expectations, a lot of times their health is a big part of that as well. I think the Spurs have actually been pretty close to what I thought they would be also, to be honest. But I think they've been winning at a higher clip than a lot of people thought. But
their defense is way better than I thought it would be.
That's true. Yeah. Their overall defense has been really outstanding. All right, let's talk a little bit more here about the Pacers. One of their big problems, they are 25th overall this season in bench net rating, negative 5.0 net rating for their bench guys. And then since the All-Star break, their starters have been playing well. They've been starting Teague, Turner, Paul George, Thad Young, and CJ Miles. Teague, Turner, and George are the only guys averaging over 30 minutes a game. They've been playing Monte mostly at backup point guard, a little bit with the starters. Aaron Brooks and Joe Young are kind of out of the rotation. I think that's probably the way that they should have gone. Too bad for Joe Young. I mean, I think he's 24 already. Had a promising summer league his first year and then has shown very little since then. It did not impress me at all at the D-League showcase when he's playing for the Fort Wayne Med Ants, and obviously Brooks is on the downside. Miles Turner continues to have a wonderful season. He's averaging 2.1 blocks. Oddly enough, though, nobody else on this team averages more than 0.4 blocks per game. You'd hope that Paul George could get a few more blocks than that. I don't know where he's been previously in his career, but he's not a huge, like, weak side guy as far as, like, defending the rim. Part of that being because, you know, he really balked at playing in any kind of power forward role, and so now that they brought in Thad Young to do that. Thad, not been an effective rim protector, though. I mean, his defensive value comes to the extent he has it from preventing penetration, switching out on the perimeter. He allows 59% shooting at the rim, only defended 216 shots, which is pretty low for a power forward. Turner, well, though,
that's also interesting, though. I wanted to go to Thad Young because that is part of what exacerbated the issues back when they had Monte in the starting lineup, was that you want somebody who's a little bit bigger, a little bit more even sized, can handle himself. And CJ Miles actually played some four for this team last year, so it makes sense to use him in that spot. You're not going to have that weak side rim protection anyway, so why not go with something where he can be a little bit more fluid?
Yeah, and I think they've really benefited from Miles' spot up shooting rather than Ellis, and I think that I don't want to say turn their season around, but it definitely helped them when Monte had that groin injury, and he actually hasn't been as bad now coming off the bench as he was as a starter. Turner, getting back to him, he has defended 626 shots at the rim this season per NBA.com. That's when you're within 5 feet of a shot at the rim. That is very good, 9.5 per game, second in the NBA behind Rudy Gobert. But he does allow 49.7% shooting. That's basically about average for a big. So that's not amazing, but at least he is getting into position. And not all of those plays are created equal, obviously. You know, you could just be trailing the play and happen to be within 5 feet, but usually it's a pretty decent proxy for whether you're in position to potentially affect a shot or not. They have to do that cutoff at some point. So that's at least helpful. And he's been, of course, important. He's just been making some incremental improvements. Where would you put him in comparison to Porzingis at this point of like who the better prospect is going forward? We're going to talk about Porzingis on the Knicks in a little bit.
God, it's funny because I got heat for having Turner over Porzingis on that time of the draft. I like what Porzingis does offensively. He's so much more versatile, even if the Knicks don't use it. And I think that's not fair to hold against him. You know, like the idea that he can do more coming off screens and a little bit more in that way. And also, he's not going to be a perfect rim protector, but I think playing at center, he can do a good enough job disrupting. So I narrowly go Porzingis, but I like both these guys quite a bit.
Yeah, I think that Turner, we know what he is. He's a center. He's been playing center. He defends the rim adequately. And he's not the offensive player that Porzingis is as a shooter, but he's maybe even able to do a little bit more around the basket, perhaps, than Porzingis at this point. But the worry for Porzingis is just maybe that he could never hold up at center. Maybe he just never gets there. And then as a power forward, he's going to be a defensive liability because he's too slow. And we'll see whether... I still think Porzingis has a significantly higher ceiling due to his shooting ability. But Turner, there's less of a chance that he just kind of doesn't develop in comparison to Porzingis. And also, I think he's, you know, complain as we will about some of the Pacers' moves, I think they're still overall a quality organization with a pretty decent culture. So it's a tough question. I think I would still rather have Porzingis, especially due to the upside, but Turner is making it a conversation.
He is. Ready to move on to Miami?
Yes.
The Heat are 33-35, a continually ridiculous 9-3 since the last time we did this, and that does not include the win streak. I don't believe it includes it at all. 19th in offense, 5th in defense, positive 0.8 net rating, and currently they have a 76% chance of making the playoffs, 2% title odds, which is awesome, and project to be 7th in the East with 41 wins.
Yeah, they had a nice win against New Orleans as DeMarcus Cousins picked up his 19th technical foul of the season, setting an NBA record for the technical suspension era. I talked to someone in the Heat organization a couple of weeks ago and basically asked them, like, how the hell are you guys doing this? And the biggest thing that he pointed to was they're really playing with a lot of pace and playing the way that Goran Dragic wants to play, the way that he played in his best years in Phoenix, pushing the ball, that transition offense, playing with a lot of intensity, running. That's what really has made the difference for them offensively. And in watching them play, I watched their game against the Raptors on Friday of last week when they took an 18-point lead at halftime. That was definitely apparent. When Dragic gets the ball, if he gets a defensive rebound or they outlet it to him, he is just trying to run it down teams' throats. And he has been fantastic. He had that ugly eye injury, but he actually was back against the Pels. More amazing three-point shooting for him. And I think it was important for Dragic to be the lead dog offensively because he's had all these situations where he would have this great season and then Eric Bledsoe would come in and they'd bring in Isaiah Thomas and he'd be pissed off. And then he wanted to go to Miami, but then really Dwayne Wade was always going to be the alpha. He would slow it down. He got all the crunch time reps. And Dragic, while I think he is a great player, is not a guy who seems to have just the most natural confidence in the world and is not the most assertive personality. But now that they've put him, perhaps unintentionally, in a situation where he is really running the show, his three-pointer, has no conscience on that. I mean, the fact that he's taking so much harder attempts and so many more this year and shooting well over 40%, and last year he was 31%, I think is huge. And three-point shooting overall from this Heat team has been completely ridiculous.
It has been. And you think about the idea of pace, and there's been a criticism in prior years levied at teams that are bad at playing at a high pace because it exhibits the idea of, you know, like that you're going to get beaten. And certainly Miami is not as good in terms of talent as some of the teams ahead of them, but they execute and try hard on defense, and they're underrated in terms of talent. It's just kind of strangely structured. And also a lot of those players have really responded to being in this situation. Deion Waiters is an obvious one, but James Johnson has also really changed himself and made himself back to being kind of the player a lot of us thought he would be early on.
Manny Navarro of the Miami Herald had a great article on the way that he has transformed his body. He weighed 274. I mean, you remember me complaining that he looked fat last year. And I mean, that's crazy for a guy like him to be 274. Amazing that he was actually able to be as quick as he was at 274. And now he's lost like 30 or 40 pounds. And you can just tell the huge difference that it's made in his game. And he's also shooting a lot of three-pointers. I'll just go through a few of these three-point stats here. Tyler Johnson shooting 36.5%, but he's on pretty big volume. James Johnson has taken 200 threes. He's only hitting 33%, but that's enough volume that you got to guard him out there now. And I mean, that's still, especially if you're in the half court, 33%, that's basically shooting 50% on twos. That's efficient. Deion Waiters, 40% from three on 210 attempts. Rodney Magruder, who no one had ever heard of coming into this year, 35% on 177 attempts, and he's a good defensive player. Wayne Ellington has taken 310 threes, and Zach Lowe noted that Spo has actually busted out some of the old Ray Allen sets for him. He's shooting a great percentage. Luke Babbitt has been on fire. He's really sped up his release, 43% on 176 attempts for him. Really, the only guy you could look at who's disappointing from three is Josh Richardson, who has played, you know, really half the season only, and he's at 29% on 163 attempts. Even Okaro White, who again is sort of like a 3-and-D athlete combo forward type of guy, 40% from three on 63 attempts. So they could all just be having a really hot shooting time. But I do think they are getting plenty of open looks by pushing the ball in transition, and they've been emphasizing the three and making them. I don't know how well this is going to continue. I think they're still really more of a defensive team. You noted that they're fifth in defense, 19th in offense, but since they started being good, they are excellent in offense. And this will be really an interesting test case for the projection systems with the Heat of how good are we going to rate them in the playoffs? Are you going to rate them based on the last 41 games when they're probably going to go like something close to 30 and 10? Or how much do you include the first games in that projection? Do you look at their overall net rating on the season, which was always good even when they were going to 11 and 30? They were not that bad. They had a ton of injuries. I mean, the last team I can think of that started off so poorly and then had a run like this, I want to say it was George Karl's first team with the Nuggets, where he came in and they went like 32-8 at the end of the year and then just like promptly lost in the first round anyway. So the idea of how much you rank over the whole season, it's not like they've made any trades where it would have changed the performance that much either, is an interesting one. But I mean, from a statistical standpoint, over these last few games, like the second half of the season, they've been a better team than really anyone in the East, maybe except for maybe even close to anyone in the East, just from a net rating standpoint. And really, you know, they don't have the talent, but probably against, if you're like, hey, this is just their team and this is what they are the second half of the year, you would say that they could be in a fight with anybody except for Cleveland.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And the fact that they're still in play for at least the sixth seed means that they could, I know that there are people who want to see that Miami-Cleveland series, but if they can get past that and get to another team, they could put a scare into just about anybody.
I mean, they're only two games behind the Pacers right now.
Yeah.
Like they could get into the sixth seed. One other thing I wanted to say is now they have this issue. Deion Waiters was saying, hey, I really want to be in Miami. And he'll surely, of course, opt out of the second year of that room exception that he has the player option for. He's only due to make $3 million next year. But they're going to have to use cap space if they want to re-sign him. And same thing with James Johnson. Same thing with Wayne Ellington. Well, Ellington might be like 9 guaranteed for next year, though. I can't remember.
I believe he is.
Yeah, okay. So they could keep him around if they wanted to. They'll have to make a decision on him, though. I'm guessing his guarantee date is probably before. Yeah, let me look that up, actually. Before the offseason starts. Oh no, his guarantee date is the first day after the 2017 moratorium. So they will actually be able to wait on him if they want to keep him around for $6.3 million next year. They'll be able to. So that'll be useful. But yeah, I mean, they'll have to use cap space on all these guys that they're going to bring back.
It's going to be just a wild circumstance for them, just because you're dealing with all of these guys at once, and they're all A, unrestricted, and B, you don't have bird rights on him. So it's going to be fun to see what they do. I said last year that Miami had the most complicated offseason in the league. That's not true this year, but they definitely have one of the most interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see whether they feel like they can do better than these guys, and then whether those guys feel they can do better than Miami too. I mean, James Johnson is 30. You know, this could be his chance to capitalize. His next contract will probably be a bad one if he gets paid based on his performances here, just because he's older and obviously got into unbelievable shape. But all right, let's get to Milwaukee. Watched them last night in great detail for the Twitter NBA show Second Screen that Danny was way too busy to join me for. But that's actually true. I don't hold it against you.
Thank you. I don't want to have to yell at you, but yeah, it's the Bucks are really putting it together in a surprising way after Jabari's injury. 33-34, 9-4 since the last 15-60. They're 10th in offense, 20th in defense, a positive 1.2 net rating, and after the events of yesterday, they have a 55% chance of making the playoffs and are projected to be 10th in the East at 39 wins. And I talked about before how Indiana's playoff odds went up 10% yesterday. Milwaukee's went up 18 because they won a game that the projections didn't expect them to win against the Clippers in LA, and the Bulls and Hornets lost.
Yeah, and so it's really them, the Heat, Indiana, the Bulls, who am I forgetting, and Detroit. Three teams for five spots at this point. And the Bucks, I mean, this 9-4 really came out of nowhere after the Jabari injury. That said, I hope that this late run does not convince them that they should keep Jason Kidd, because I feel that they are often winning in spite of him. Last night's fourth quarter, no exception, Giannis was in foul trouble in the first half, and he basically still sat Giannis out for like 10 minutes in the second half. He was sitting on 22 minutes, and he didn't even bring him back in until there were about 6 minutes left in the fourth quarter. And then Chris Middleton just took him out. He was having a nice game with maybe about 7 minutes left. He was on 31 minutes, so he needed a little bit of a break, but then came back with like for one possession at the very end of the game. He was going with Dellavedova and Brogdon, who I thought were doing well guarding Chris Paul. Brogdon was really good on Chris Paul last night. Even had a steal, just ripped him up in transition as Paul tried to go into like one of his fancy dribbling moves in transition. Brogdon ripped him up, which you never ever see. And Deli was doing a good job guarding Redick off the ball. But then they had Tony Snell at the three instead of Middleton, which really didn't make any sense to me. I guess the thought was that they had Crawford in and Snell would be better defensively, but especially because Middleton had been really effective attacking those smaller guards, I thought that certainly Middleton's advantage against someone like Crawford or Redick was much greater than the reverse of that. And then they didn't play Giannis enough. And then they actually had like John Henson in for a lot of the game too, until they finally brought Greg Monroe back in at the end. And Monroe last night played the best defensive game I've ever seen him play. He was actually like legitimately good defensively. And it was helped by the fact that the Clippers really have no spacing. They play the two bigs. And the Clippers just weren't able to get the ball to DeAndre Jordan when Monroe would come over and help, especially on Blake Griffin. That was the last play of the game. Chris Paul and Griffin ran a pick and roll with 5 seconds left, and they threw it to Griffin on the roll. Monroe stepped up. There wasn't time to get it to Spates, who was actually in instead of DeAndre Jordan. And Griffin had to throw up a tough floater that barely missed, but it was just a great job by Monroe getting into position, not flopping as well, just standing strong and making it a tough shot. And he did that many, many times, stepping up on drivers. And then offensively, he really had a hand in almost all of their buckets late, mostly. Kid was going to some pretty simple stuff, trying to get the small pick and roll to get a small onto Giannis, and they would switch it. Chris Paul would be fronting, and Monroe was fantastic, because usually if you're the opposite big and they're fronting on a post up, what you want to do is you run to the free throw line, and that will then gives you the angle to dump it down to the guy who's being fronted in the post, because now that guy is on the wrong side. But usually the opposite big will just kind of take too long to realize it, or someone will have to yell for him to do it, and then he'll kind of jog there and everyone knows what's coming, and the guy who's fronting in the post can get back around in plenty of time. Monroe, basically, as soon as Giannis got down there, he ran to the free throw line, and Monroe had some great backdoor passes, some great dump downs, was really one of the better all-around games that we've seen from him. They're still starting Thon Maker and the Keith Bogans, though, although even Keith Bogans didn't play this small an amount of minutes at the start of each half.
It's also kind of interesting to see where this team is going, because I was really impressed with the way Malcolm Brogdon played against Chris Paul. I think you can make an argument that Chris Paul is maybe the single hardest cover for Brogdon, because he's fast and he's smart as hell and he's crafty. And Brogdon, as you said, he ripped him that time. There were a lot of other possessions where Paul just couldn't get where he wanted to on the floor. And yeah, Brogdon's an older rookie, but there aren't many players in the league, period, that can do that sort of performance.
Yeah, Brogdon, he doesn't make mental mistakes, and he's just a tank. And he's got some pretty quick feet. I mean, he's not an explosive athlete, but he does, like, if he's running a pick and roll, he's a better finisher than, say, like, Deli is, right? Like he can, his floater is a little bit better. He can actually get to the rim. He can dunk the basketball. I don't know. I wonder if Deli could even dunk in, like, an empty gym. He probably could, but
I think he could.
Probably underrating him. But yeah, Brogdon, again, really impressive. I think he's going to be around for a long time. It'd be interesting to see whether the Bucks want to move on from Dellavedova in the offseason. Right now, they're slated to have about $10 million in cap space, but that doesn't include the $6 million cap hold for Tony Snell, who we talked about with Brooklyn, that might be a target for them, or maybe another kind of downtrodden team that wants to get a younger player into their system at the two. So maybe they'd say, hey, Brogdon's just going to be our point guard of the future. I like that too, because they've got plenty of other ball handling with Jabari and Giannis, even if Brogdon isn't quite a traditional point guard. And then the amount of switching that you can do with Brogdon, because he's so strong, is really fantastic.
Something else I wanted to mention, not on that point, is that this is going to be a crucial part in the Bucks' schedule coming up. So they have a 4-game West Coast road trip, but two of the games are against the Lakers and the Kings. So that'll be, you know, if they can take handle those and at least get a split. But then the other two are challenging. They face the Warriors on the tail end of a back-to-back after facing the Lakers. And then they wait a couple days, then they play the Blazers, who've done a nice job recently. So if they can go 2-2, I think they're fine. If they go 3-1 or better, then we start to talk about this as being a likely playoff team.
Yeah, the Kings have been frisky, though, lately. I mean, that's going to it's going to be a dogfight, that game. They've been playing hard. And it is interesting to see the Kings have outperformed my expectations, certainly, since they moved on from DeMarcus Cousins. All right, we'll get to the Knicks in a second. We want to talk about Kristaps Porzingis' season. Some have described it as a disappointment. We want to dig into that a little bit further. But first, this from SeatGeek. With the tournament on right now, a lot of you probably want to travel with your school, go see some of these games. SeatGeek, an awesome way to do that. It just takes so much of the pain and the time out of buying tickets. It was great to be able to get tickets when they first became available on the internet, but then there are a billion sites that you had to look at to make sure that you were getting the best deal. Now with SeatGeek, that fear is alleviated. They aggregate together ticket buying sites so you can just go in one place and not have FOMO on some other deal. And then the second part of SeatGeek that's so awesome is they rank every ticket via their proprietary technology. Danny worked in the ticket business. He agrees with the way they do their rankings. And that enables you to just look at the section where you want to sit, pick out the ticket that they think is the best deal, and you're done. You just spent 2 minutes instead of spending 20 minutes comparing all this stuff, and you're probably getting a better deal anyway. SeatGeek also backs all their tickets with 100% guarantee. You don't have to worry about the authenticity of tickets. And the best part, if you haven't tried them yet, despite the fact that they've been on the show for so long, there still are people who, for whatever reason, have not tried SeatGeek yet. SeatGeek will send you $20 when you enter my code CAPSPACE at checkout. CAPSPACE, easy to remember, of course. We talk about it all the time on the program. And you make your first purchase, enter that CAPSPACE code, SeatGeek will send you $20. So that's the free SeatGeek app, or you can do it on computer as well. Enter the CAPSPACE code, $20 rebate. Just one of the best apps out there, SeatGeek. All right, how are the Knickerbockers doing these days?
Well, they did get that win against the Pacers. They're 27-41, 4-8 since the last time we did this. 16th in offense, 24th in defense, negative 3.6 net rating, projected to be 12th in the East with 32 wins.
How are they doing in the tankathon?
They would have been doing better if they had beaten the Pacers, actually, but they're okay. I mean, I think
And that was kind of a comfortable win, too, as I recall.
Yeah, it was. So if you look at it right now, there are five teams that are basically the bottom five, it looks like right now. You have the Lakers, the Nets, the Suns, the Magic, and the Sixers. So then outside of that, you have three teams that are still periodically at least trying: the Pelicans, the Kings, and the Knicks. And so whoever of that group, if any of those teams decides to fall off, they can basically lock in the six most ping pong balls.
Yeah, and you'd have to imagine that the Kings, despite their pluckiness, are the most likely of those teams to do that. But hey, you know, if Scal keeps putting up 32 a game, they're not going to stop playing him. and Cauley-Stein has been pretty decent lately too. They're re-emphasizing the triangle. Phil Jackson came down, did a little camp with the guards. Re-emphasizing a complicated offense that isn't any good even when you do know how to run it is a great way to tank a little bit. There have been some reports, actually. I think Isola said that Jeff Hornacek could be on the hot seat, even though I think he has two more years on his contract left after this one, I guess, because it's pretty incredible to me that after 3 years, Phil Jackson, who's supposed to have absolute power in the organization, hasn't been able to just get someone to run the triangle reliably. If that's really what he wants, like, that he can't just get a coach who's going to do that. And, you know, maybe that's because the triangle doesn't work and coaches want to actually win games, so they go away from it. That was like the big problem with Derek Fisher too, had his own issues, but that was part of why they supposedly had a falling out. And Hornacek has run it less as well. Now they're supposedly getting back to it. But for Phil, after 3 years, to have this excuse and have this feeling of, he shouldn't be able to even plausibly say, oh, the reason that we're not winning is because we haven't been triangly enough, right? Like, he should be able to at least get a coach in there who's going to run it enough so you can say, okay, hey, we've tried really hard at it. It's not working, as opposed to like, oh yeah, you know, we just haven't been good, so we have to just try harder at running the triangle.
It's very, very frustrating, and you kind of wonder how that power dynamic is going to shift over time. But Dolan has basically said that Jackson, you know, as on his side of the mutual option, that he wants Jackson to be back, and it's a lot of money for Phil. So, you know, I don't understand. It's not like I don't think there's going to be a better job on the horizon, especially now that the Lakers are so well handled, or I mean settled at this point. And I think
you're talking about for Phil, if he yeah. were to opt out. Yeah, yeah, no, yeah, were... why would he do that at this point? Yeah. He's due $12 million, and he's not even by most accounts working that hard. I mean let's be clear, I think there's really no argument that Phil doesn't deserve to be fired, right?
He's done a good
job. He drafted Porzingis. That's it, right? Well, Hernan Gomez was good. Yeah.
Yeah, and Kuzminskas too. I think that they're fines, you know, kind of on the fringes, and then Porzingis have been good. But the big negatives are larger than the one big positive and the other smaller positive.
Yeah. If it weren't for the Noah contract, and this is the same feeling I had with Jim Buss, if it weren't for the Noah contract, you actually would have some plausible deniability here on, hey, we drafted this guy, you know, we at least still have flexibility going forward. I didn't hate the Rose trade as much as everyone else did. Rose has actually been okay offensively this year.
Yeah, and Courtney Lee's a fine contract, you know, like I don't think he fits in with where they're going long term just due to his age, but it's a fine number. I have no problem with it.
Yeah, so, but yeah, it's really the Noah contract that was just, there was no reason to give that. They agreed to it before free agency even started, essentially. They were supposed to put him over the top. He was terrible. He's been injured. Both of those you probably could have predicted. So, yeah.
I think we should get to the main
event. It hasn't been good.
I think we should get to the main event,
though.
Yeah,
thank you. I've been rambling too much today. We got to get through this.
But so, yeah, Kristaps,
what's your thought on that? Like whether this has been a disappointing second year for him. What do you think? Just off the top of your head.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, what I've noticed is that he's played more this year like a power forward. So he's shooting less at the rim, shooting more from three, and certain parts of that are good. He's a good three-point shooter. I think he's making more
offensive
of them this
boards
year.
Are down.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And is that trade-off.
Defensive boards are down.
Yeah, so he's playing more in that vein, and he's doing an all right job. I believe his PER is slightly down, which is not the end-all be-all, but is interesting all the same, because you would expect...
And I think he's actually, offensively, he's been better. Part of the reason his PER is down is just because league-wide offense is just so much higher. I mean, like, some of these guys, like LeBron James, is having one of his best-ever statistical seasons, and his PER is only like 26, I think just in part because the overall offense is higher this year.
Well, and his rebounding being down certainly doesn't help, because that takes out a base of his success.
Sure.
And he's getting to the line less, which is a concern.
Yeah, that is a concern. I think, to me, I'm not concerned in the sense that, oh, he's stagnated. He is, despite what you've noted, he has made incremental improvements in some areas that I thought were very important. Key among those is that he shot only 58% at the rim last year. That's 70% this year. And he's taking just about the same percentage of his shots at the rim this year. So that was a huge issue last year. He's gotten stronger. He's really worked to improve his touch when he's not dunking. He had 52 dunks last year. He already has 68 this year. So that's definitely a big deal for me. His three-point shooting. He has improved his three-point shooting. He is at and improved his three-point attempt rate. He's up. That's up 5%, the attempt rate. And then from three, he's shooting almost 37% now instead of 33%. So that's really good. He has been off on long twos compared to last year, but I think that's really kind of more of an aberration. Has not really been effective at all in the post. From 3 to 10 feet, shooting in the low 30s as he did last year. So that has not been too good. He has developed that nice bank shot off the glass from the left wing about 15 feet out. I think that's good to see him add that to the arsenal. He's taking more threes further out as well. I think offensively, he's looked pretty good, not passing any more than he did last year. But another important thing to remember is, because his usage is about the same, actually a little bit lower than last year, they got Derrick Rose on this team now. And Rose has a high usage takes a ton of shots. And Carmelo has played a little bit more this year too. Hernan Gomez, more of an offensive threat than some of the centers that they've had in there. He also has had to deal with playing with Noah a lot, and Noah is horrendous offensively. So that's something that has kind of crimped his ability to get to the basket. So I think he, for the most part, to me, I don't want to say he's like on schedule for becoming a superstar, but to say that he hasn't improved this year, I think he's looked like a better player, both subjectively, and then the stats have backed that up in the stuff that I think largely is important. And he's been more efficient overall this year, 54% true shooting instead of 52.
And I don't think we've really had the information to be able to evaluate him defensively. We both feel that eventually it's worth trying him at the five. He hasn't played there that much. They have been outscored with him at center, but again, that ties in with a couple other questions that we've discussed before. So offensively, yeah, I see a lot that I really, really like from him. And the idea, I wrote about this actually for Real GM a couple months into his career, about that he for a short time looked like this special player who could make threes and get offensive rebounds. And what I kind of posited at the point, because it was so hard to find a parallel for that, is it can't continue because those players don't exist. Yeah. And that's pretty much what happened.
Yeah, I mean, after, I remember his first month last year, he had like a 14% offensive rebound rate, and he finished last year at 7%, and now he's down to 5.6. So that's really like almost below average for a power forward at this point. And again, he's playing with the traditional center most of the time. He's only played center for 406 minutes this year, thanks to NBA Wowie for helping me do this research. Shooting only 38% from the field at center, 49% true shooting, and no higher of a usage than normal either. And as you mentioned, they've been slightly outscored 1 point per 100 possessions with him at center in those 406 minutes. But I don't make anything of that. I think he should be better offensively at center. He's probably just missing shots. It's only 406 minutes, so I'm not going to go crazy about that. I still think that what he needs to be is a center who you just run pick and pop for him every time and see what he can do then in pick and pop. The one thing that he's not going to do compared to Dirk is he doesn't have the ability, I think, to really punish guys off the dribble. Unless it, like, if he's being guarded by a center, he can do like a crossover and pull up for a long two. But just getting all the way to the rim against a good defensive player, or even a smaller defensive player, the way Dirk could, he just doesn't have that type of quickness or ball skills or feel for putting the ball on the floor and blowing by guys the way young Dirk could. Young Dirk was really like a grab and go guy, pushing in transition. Porzingis is not that. So I do think offensively he's got to be a center, because at power forward he's too slow. He's just getting blown by. He can't close out to the perimeter. And rebounding is a problem for him. He only has an 11% total rebound rate, which is not good. I mean, that's only 2% better than, or 1% better than average, basically. So I think, like, offensively, I've been encouraged. This has not been, of course, a system that's been tailored enough to him. That's still the case. If they move on from Carmelo and he had this year, then I might be a little concerned that, I mean, I think he's going to be a good player regardless. But if we're talking about him being like an absolute superstar, I never felt like that was going to be the case for him anyway. I didn't think he was going to be a type of guy who's going to be a top 10 player in the league. I thought he could be a guy who blocks shots and shoots some threes and scores pretty well, but not a guy you just throw it to and say, hey, create some offense. And so he's right on the path pretty much that I would have thought for him, especially in what's been, you know, yet another weirdo toxic environment that he actually even commented on in the media recently about.
Would you say it was a fair distinction to say that he was a potential, like a likely all-star, but not all NBA? Like, that's kind of where the area that I saw him.
Yeah, I think so. And also remember, he was started the season off a lot better as well. And he's had these nagging injuries too. That's one thing that's been a little bit disappointing, is he'll seem to miss a couple of games with a sprained ankle all the time, or a muscle pull or something like that. But no, I don't think it's been a disappointment. It hasn't been like some enormous breakout. Anyone who is trying to talk about him in the same breath as Karl Towns, you were wrong. That was always the case. But he's still looking like he's going to be a very solid player. But to say like, oh, hey, this guy's going to be a superstar, let's focus everything on building around him, I don't know that he's quite that level of player. And if he's going to get there, he's got a lot of improvement to do in terms of strength, and especially just becoming, if he becomes a great defensive player, he can get there. But there's a lot of way to go there.
Well, that said, he's probably still going to be their best piece, specifically with their talent, to build sure. around for at least the next couple of years. So, but at the same point, you know, he's not that focal point necessarily, you still go best player available unless it's a direct conflict. Then at that point, you make that decision. That was something that I was so critical of the Knicks doing, is that I thought they got some players who were in direct conflict with what he did well.
Let's get to Orlando here, who we'll see in person later tonight in Oakland.
We will. The Magic are 24-44, 3-8 since the last 15-60. A less surprising 29th in offense, a more surprising 23rd in defense, negative 6.7 net rating, still projected to be 14th in the East with 29 wins, but they're right in the mix with the Sixers for kind of that spot.
Yeah, last in the Southeast by quite a significant margin with that 24-44 record. Terrence Ross, since the trade, he's been playing 32 minutes a game, 33 minutes a game, actually, has not been effective in those 10 games. 27% from three, taking half of his shots from down there, 39% overall from the field, not really getting to the foul line either. True shooting percentage, only 47%, 9.1 PER. That's actually only slightly better than Mario Hezonja's overall PER on the season of 7.2. Hezonja has been playing since the trade 19.2 minutes a game, but only 7.3 points, 0.8 assists, 29% on threes, and they are outscored by 5.8 points per game in his 19 minutes per game. So that's well into a negative double-digit net rating if you extrapolate it out over 100 possessions since the All-Star break in those 10 games. So I'm sure we'll get a look at him tonight, but nothing at all to indicate some encouragement with him.
Why are you trying to hurt my heart, Nate? But yeah,
hurt your heart? Is that what you said?
No, hurt my heart. No.
Yeah, because I think hurt your hurt is better because you already have been hurt by Hezonja.
Oh yeah. But let's turn a little bit to the positive. Elfrid Payton has had 3 triple doubles, I believe, in the last 5 games. Has looked better, and a big key to that is that he's actually making shots at the rim. He's still not making threes, but he's making shots at the rim.
Yeah, he was horrendous, especially his rookie year, and I think last year as well. He might have been under 50% both of those years. Now he's up to 62%. Also 42% from floater range, which is decent. Still can't make a three, even though his three looks better than it has in past years, just subjectively. 26%. Hopefully I can get a look at his warm-up tonight and get an idea kind of where he's at just in an empty gym. He's at least shooting 39% on long twos outside of 16 feet. That's like, you know, not an efficient shot, but at least like he'll take a shot when they go under there from there. In defensively, he hasn't been a part of a good defense, but he still has one of the better steal rates. Steal rate is actually, it's not as good as I thought it would be, only 1.9%. I had hoped for more from that, and he really was like, when I saw him first get out there, I was like, he would get some steals that you would never see. And so kind of a disappointment that, you know, that's a decent steal rate, but it's only 0.2% better than Nikola Vucevic's 1.7% steal rate. So it's not amazing. Ooh, that's for sure.
You put a shot chart in our podcast plan. Is that just Aaron Gordon shooting since the All-Star break?
Yes, it is. Yeah, when he has really returned to playing the four in his starting lineup, including Fournier, Ross, Payton, and Nikola Vucevic.
So it's not, you know, it's different in composition, but he's still not hitting threes, 19% from above the break, and then barely any in the corners, but making 64 of his shots have been in the restricted area, which is great, and making 70% of them is very good as well.
The biggest thing is that he had been taking a third of his shots from three-point range, making 28% of them. Now at least he's not making his threes, but that's only comprising about 20% of his shots, and more, he's taken basically more than half of his shots right at the rim. And that's really what he needs to be doing as a player at this point, working more as a play finisher. They've been trying, you know, him being the next Paul George, like, let's wait a couple of years on that, because he's not close there. I was critical of the Magic at that draft for taking, and this is a bit of an aside here, for taking Gordon over Dante Exum, who I like better. Exum, of course, had the torn ACL. He's starting to play a little bit better recently. I think Gordon, obviously, is the better prospect at this point. But what do you think the chances are that Exum actually could turn out to be better than Gordon when it's all said and done?
I think it's actually closer than a lot of people think. I also was super high on Exum. I was probably higher on him than you were, actually. I'd say about 40%.
Really? I had him at number 2 on my board.
I had him at 1.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, but, that was the 2014 draft. And I think I'm feeling pretty good about my 16 evaluations. And 15, I definitely missed on Porzingis. Although, you know, again, we'll see how these guys all turn out.
We'll just keep going back to 2013. I'll just be happy about that. I'll just keep promoting that instead.
Yeah, of course, 2014 was the first year that I actually really like had access to the film to watch some of the top guys. I think my 14 draft was board was Jabari, Exum, Smart, Embiid, Wiggins, Randall, Gordon. Yeah, I think that's what it was. Randall and Gordon might have been switched. I can't remember. A few more here. You know, now that we're going to get back to the actual Orlando Magic, worst bench net rating in the league, -9.5, which is surprising because they had all these, the one thing that you thought they had coming into the season, if they didn't have any star power, was at least they spent a bunch of money on these bench pieces. So you could have thought that maybe their bench could be helpful, but not at all. -9.5. Biombo has really disappointed me defensively this year. I thought that he at least could be a force on the boards, not really that much of a force on the offensive glass. Defensive boards hasn't been that great either. Block percentage is down only 4.2%, hasn't really been the force that he was the last 2 years there. So that contract not looking too amazing. Maybe if he ends up being the starter and they really commit to him by trading Vucevic, he can start to look better again. But that's a contract that I thought wouldn't be that terrible, and it's actually not looking too good so far.
Well, it's also he runs into the issue beyond the defensive limitations this year, which puts a much greater shadow on it, that there are just so many centers right now, and there are players that have reasonable contracts, and so you can go through it in that way, or you can sell yourself on a young center that's going to be a little bit low. Like, would you rather pay, I don't know, like one of these kind of like drifting centers that's probably going to make a lot less than him, or even Jahlil Okafor if you can get him in a trade, just like going in that direction as opposed to Biombo at $17 million a year flat?
Yeah, I mean, I thought Biombo at least has the potential to be a game-changing force on the boards and defensively.
So did I.
He was a big reason why I was very high on their defense this year, and he just hasn't produced at all. And really, when you that net -9.5 bench net rating, the starters actually have been in the green since the break, or in the black, I guess you could say, if we're going to go business. But the that -9.5 net rating for the bench over the whole season, and they spent what, 17 on Biombo, and that's going to go on for a lot longer, 7 on DJ Augustin, 15 on Jeff Green. So that's over $40 million, and then they traded for Jody Meeks as well, as making $6 million. So they basically spent well over $40 million on only bench guys to have the worst bench in the league. That is horrendous.
I don't really have anything to add to that.
A couple other notes here before we move on. Tough season for Nikola Vucevic. He takes too many long twos. He always has about 500 true shooting, which is horrible for a big center like him. But even on his preferred long two-pointers, outside of 16 feet, he's been under 40% on those. And then he's taken a few more three-pointers this year, but hasn't really hit them efficiently, only 32% on those. So again, Vucevic, even the things that he supposedly did well, he's fallen off on this year. And then, of course, we all know what his defensive limitations are. Nothing encouraging at all about this team except for the way Peyton has played, I guess. And that they now finally have Gordon at the four again. Yeah, I thought that they had been playing a little bit better recently, and they have been frisky with that starting lineup, but it's probably time for them again to rev up the tank, along with some of these other teams. They're still in the morass with Orlando and the Knicks and the Pels.
I think we'll probably talk about this on the next 15 and 60 with them, but I'm very interested to see what they do with their cap space, because they have a lot of it is going to be about who chooses to take their money, but between that and their draft pick, they're going to have some actual opportunities to make their team better now that they're, you know, not worried about overpaying Serge Ibaka to keep him after that whole thing. So what they end up doing and who says yes is going to be very interesting.
Well, and it's also going to be interesting to see who's giving out their cap space.
Also
well.
True. Let's move Philly. On to the Sixers, a team that just changed who's going to, not just, but changed who's going to give out their cap space. They're 24-43, 3-9 since the last time we did this. 30th in offense, 19th in defense, -6.3 net rating, and their 538 projects them actually to finish right now in a tie with the Magic, 29 wins.
Let's talk about Dario Saric, who has been awesome lately. As we noted on the last 15 and 60, that's been continuing. What did you think seeing him in person against the Warriors on Tuesday night?
I like him. He's works hard. He seems like he'd be a pain in the ass to guard. And I really like that in a player. I like somebody who it seems like he makes people uncomfortable. I do like him
in
better.
In what way? How do you think he makes people uncomfortable?
He's physical. Like I think he likes, especially when he gets a switch, he likes kind of like hitting on the other guy a little bit. And he can pass.
He loves contact. One thing about him. He is a tough dude and he doesn't back down for anyone. I like that about him.
And he competes and he's a good passer. I've always liked that about him. And I think he's a little more confident in his jump shot than he maybe should be right now, but it looks like it can get better as he gets more comfortable and now that he's being asked to do that all the time.
Yeah, his jumper is really flat, which is a little bit of a concern, but it does go in for him pretty well. Seeing him go through some exercises before the game, I thought his jumper looked okay. I thought that when they had that 16-point lead and then when Draymond Green and Andre Iguodala brought the defensive intensity to a frenzy, that they were unable to be successful in the fourth quarter. And Sarge was a big part of that. What he likes to do really is, get the switch, go one-on-one. He's not really fast enough to blow by pretty much anybody. He's going to try and get physical, back down, kind of work into the post, work to his spot. If you lay off him, maybe he'll take a jumper. Okay passer, but not really hasn't had a ton of assist numbers, but certainly a high skill level. Not gonna just go up and dunk on somebody. I was talking actually to an NBA observer, I guess I'll say, who says, hey, he looks like he has those national team legs because he plays with the national team every year and never really has a chance to build up his body in the off season, which I thought was an interesting observation. He can actually get up pretty, you remember that block he had in the Olympics against Pau Gasol at very end of that that game. And so if he's in space, he can actually get up pretty high, but if he's around the rim, not a ton of explosion. And I think his ability to create shots, but not really good shots, has shown in just his overall stat line this year that he's just not, you don't really see him create separation and really get open. A lot of his shots that he creates, he has the skill level to create them, but they're going to be contested. And he doesn't have the type of jump shot where you're feeling all right, he's got this beautiful arc, is imperturbable, he can make shots over contestants. So overall in the season, he's been very inefficient. They have nobody else to create a shot. McConnell is completely hopeless in that regard against good defense as well. And Saric, as long as it's not really a point guard type, he's pretty switchable. Obviously the Warriors have a lot of good switch defenders, but he wasn't able to beat those type of players. I'm a little bit more down on him certainly than his box score stats over these last couple of months would indicate, that if he might win rookie of the year or something, I don't think he's some future star at all. I think he can be an effective player, but probably someone who should be coming off the bench on a good team, especially due to the fact that, he doesn't really defend either forward position particularly well.
That's exactly where I was going to go, actually, is that there could be an uncomfortable situation with many teams that Saric is a player who is talented and it seems like he works hard that is not good enough to start on a good team, but the Sixers have the good fortune, as it looks like now, you never know for sure, that they can justifiably put him down there. Ben Simmons is as good as we hope he's going to be, then Simmons is ahead of him in the rotation. They have a ton of different assets, cap space, their own picks, other people's picks to get the other forward spot. And then you can slide him in, and you don't want to count your chickens too far, but Saric and Rashawn Holmes, if that's your starting or your backup 4 and 5, that's incredible. That's a really good combination. Saric is cheap for another 3 seasons. I think Holmes is cheap for another 2 seasons. You go with that and you can roll with it. And yeah, if they keep Jahlil Okafor, that's totally fine. That's not slighting him. It's just that that's a really good backup combination, the two, Holmes and Saric together.
A little bit more on Saric before we move on. As the pick and roll ball handler, 5th percentile, he has 21 points on 48 possessions, turns it over 31% of the time. And then even his passes as well, as a pick and roll ball handler, he's shot or turned it over 48 times, and he's only passed to a shooter who shot the ball 13 times. So in the pick and roll, he's not able to draw 2 players to the ball and make a play. Again, doesn't really have the explosion. I think if you're switching even a center onto him in a 4-5 pick and roll, most centers could keep up with him okay. He's not just blowing by guys necessarily. He is excellent in transition. He'll run the floor hard. He had a couple of really nice transition plays, and he does play hard. He gets on the offensive glass. That's actually one of the ways that he has been effective this year. And then also as a role man in pick and roll, in the 9th percentile, mostly doing pick and pops has been pretty ineffective there as well. So again, can create shots, not necessarily efficient. I think he's 22 or 23 right now. So not maybe as much upside as some guys, but I think he's going to be a good player in this league for a long time. But if you're going to say that, yeah, he's going to be our primary offensive engine a lot of the time, I think you're going to be disappointed. And then you run into the issue, you know, I think he can operate that way off the bench for a few minutes a game in each half, but then you run into the issue of how does he fit off the ball, playing more as a spot up guy, maybe as a role man in the pick and roll who can make a play if he's not switchable, which a lot of teams can do too if he's playing at the four. So he is a little bit difficult of a guy to fit in if he's not going to be the main guy, and if he's the main guy, he's probably not going to be that efficient. A lot of European players run into that. He's better than most of those guys, but it still is an issue. Let's talk about some of your observations on some of their other guys.
It was interesting that I liked TLC, Timothée Loibe-Cabarrot, more as a cutter, as an offensive player than his defense. I think he just needs to get stronger.
Smarter too. I mean, he committed just a couple of bad fouls where he like ran up jump shooters' backs and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think he's the one who fouled Curry shooting a three, and it was because he was a little bit late and a little bit too zealous on it. And I still like him. I think especially when you get a guy in the 20s, if you think that he can be a rotation player for you 2 or 3 years into that rookie scale contract, that's not a problem at all, and I still like him for that. I was a little bit disappointed that we didn't get to see much Justin Anderson, because he has actually had some good games against the Warriors in the past, but he didn't play a ton in that game at Oracle.
Anderson, since the trade, 59% true shooting, that's good, 17 minutes a game, 73% on 2-pointers, he's 23 out of 30, and he already has 9 dunks, but he's 6 out of 23 on threes. And just watching him shoot before the game, his shot is real flat. One thing that I noticed with Chris Dunn too is like, he, even when his makes go in, it's not like a swish, it's sort of off the back rim, just kind of barely squirts in because he's not getting enough arc on it. And then, you know, he made like 10 in a row and then he would miss 10 in a row. You know, it was one of those things where he's just probably not a very consistent stroke, and he's gonna need to be able to hit those shots if he wants to be more than a bench guy. I think he can be a semi-effective, you know, if you think of him as a stronger Corey Brewer type who can also block some shots if his jump shot never improves, I think he could get to that kind of level. But he's got to be able to make threes to really start thinking about getting like a nice second contract in the NBA. But I still like his athleticism a lot, especially like he'll get some amazing blocks at times, and his strength and his ability to get in transition.
If he can develop this summer, if he can really work hard, I could see him getting a nice spot in their rotation, kind of as that, you know, maybe the fourth swingman, which would be a good role for him if he can pull it off.
TJ McConnell, don't want to talk about him too much, but he was really good on defense against Steph Curry. I thought he just really competes. He's like a Matthew Dellavedova who actually has like some good foot speed as well. Obviously too limited to be a starting point guard for a real team, but you know, he's definitely better than Sergio, who has really disappointed me a lot. I thought Sergio could run some pick and rolls, but his jumper is so bad that he just has no gravity to force the defense to commit to him, where he can get into that great passing ability that he has. And then Jahlil Okafor actually had 4 block shots. I thought he was effective at the rim at times. And then he had some dominating stretches in the first half, scoring against guys like Pachulia. I mean, James Michael McAdoo had no chance against him. And I thought Brett Brown, I don't know if this was by design, did well to put Okafor in against a Warriors lineup, their second unit that doesn't have a lot of shooting or spacing on it. And then, of course, you know, once Steph would run a pick and roll involving Okafor, he was getting a good shot every time. But especially, I think Okafor can still be good offensively. It's more a matter of trying to look at who the opponent has in. And there are times when you can slot him in where if he can just hang around the rim, I actually think he can be okay defending the basket. It's just when he has to get out in space that it's a disaster. And he's also a pretty sorry defensive rebounder as well.
Well, it was also encouraging to see, you talked about this a little bit, but offensively, his game in Philly against the Warriors was one of his worst of the year. He was getting stripped all the time. Green was making his life hell. David West had a better game.
I want to say he had like 3 points and 7 turnovers or something like that in that game.
Something like that, yeah. And he looked a lot better. He actually just straight up beat Zaza Pachulia on one possession. He was Okafor was like 15 feet from the basket and just beat him to the hoop, which is really impressive. And I mean, not that Zaza's the most fleet of foot, but still, that wasn't something he did the first time out. And there's a lot to like about Okafor. He's one of those players, and we see this around the league, where his positives are strong. Like, I think that he can be a productive player in the NBA, but you have to use him right. And ideally, he takes part of these next 2 seasons or so, especially especially the off seasons, to sand off some of the weaknesses, and then he becomes substantially more playable.
Yeah, I still think the Spurs should try and trade for him. We'll see how much it would take.
I tried to do it in the mock deadline, and nobody was having it.
Yeah. Rashawn Holmes was awesome. He actually made a three. He's got a really slow release, and he's really got to get his legs into it, but he actually has made a couple of threes lately from the top of the key. Not going to be able to do that in a pick-and-pop situation, but I think as a spot-up, he might be able to. And then defensively, he had a lot of Warriors scared trying to get to the rim. He had two blocks that were like above the square on the backboard too, where he just got guys in the air on floaters that like not very many people are going to get to. I was just very, very impressed. And Holmes actually played in crunch time over Okafor really just, you know, not going to create a shot, obviously. That guy's a player. I mean, I think he can be a starting center in the league. Not a great one, but I think he could be a starting center. He's under contract for the minimum for two more years, both non-guaranteed.
Ridiculous.
Well, I mean, you know, it's not, I don't think, because Sam Hinkie gave out five of those contracts, the five second round picks or guys off the street, and one of them hit, and it was Rashawn Holmes, and the other guys are just kind of...
Well, Covington hit, too.
Didn't work out. Yeah, Covington was another one, right? I mean, if they're saying they basically were churning, you know, four roster spots a year with those type of guys, and in over a three-year period, they got three pretty good contributors. McConnell is another guy who's a solid backup point guard, you know, on those same type of contracts. So to take, you know, get one of those guys per year, it's actually pretty good.
Yeah, especially when you have them for another couple, because they identified it pretty quickly with those players as well. So yeah, think about if a couple other teams, Lakers, approach things that way, they could have added some depth pieces so they wouldn't have to be overpaying for every guy on the roster. The Magic could have done this as well.
Toronto Raptors.
39-28, 7-5 since the last time we did this. Fourth in offense, 13th in defense, which is rising. Plus 4.6 net rating, 2% chance of winning the title right now. Projected to be fourth in the East with 48 wins, and they're really playing their way back into making it that they can get the 3 seed, which would be different and exciting.
Yeah, helped by that Wizards loss to the Mavs, which we'll talk about a little bit later. You mentioned that the 13th in defense is rising. As we suspected, the acquisitions of Ibaka and in particular PJ Tucker appear to have helped with that. 240 minutes with Tucker on the floor, 99 defensive rating for the Raptors. Dalen Wright also has been a solid defensive player. I think that Kyle Lowry, actually with the great offensive season he's had, his defense really had slipped some this year. And with Joseph and Wright, they probably actually are a little bit better defensively without Lowry on the floor. Now, of course, the offense really sucks. And just in general, since getting Tucker and Ibaka, 6-4, 105.4 offensive rating, which is well below where they've been, of course. 102 defensive rating, though, 2.7 net rating overall. I mean, that's pretty darn good for without a guy that RPM would say is a top 10 player in the league. Also worth noting that with Patrick Patterson on the floor, they have an 11.9 overall net rating on the season. Another guy we can close the book on, Jared Zellinger, who remember was going to be their starting power forward. He played 118 minutes as a Raptor and was immediately released by the Suns, and nobody has even signed him, which is really pretty remarkable how far he's fallen. I remember, I think it was David Falk, his agent, when it came time to have some extension talks with the Celtics, I think it was in regard to Zellinger, where Falk made the comment that, yeah, if an extension offer isn't the max, I don't even consider it.
Yeah, I believe that was with him, which was fun. you talked about how, you know, Zellinger, of course, you know, is a part of the trade, and then Bebe has been pretty marginalized now because they have another quality big, and so is Jonas Valanciunas. I mean, Valanciunas did have, he had 25 against, unsurprisingly, the Pelicans, one of the few teams that plays two traditional bigs, but other than that, not only is he not closing games, he's just not generally playing as big a role.
The good news is they have an 11.7 net rating with him off the court since the trade.
Well, and he's a good player in the right role, they just need to figure out what it is.
Yeah, I mean, we should remember that he was effective both against Indiana and Miami last year, but the tenor of those series was, we're going to just bludgeon you over the head until you bleed out. That's what watching those games was like. The opponents that they're going to have to play this year in the playoffs, at least once they get beyond the first round, Washington, Boston, Cleveland, he's not gonna be able to stay on the floor against any of those teams. And I mean, it may get to the point where KC doesn't even start him anymore. I mean, I think having against a lot of those teams an Ibaka, Tucker, and Patterson three-man big man rotation would be very effective to me. I think that could really improve this Raptors defense. Now, of course, they're gonna have to rely on Lowry getting back and being regular season Lowry, because playoff Lowry has been way worse than regular season Lowry over these couple of years. And DeRozan, of course, has really struggled in the playoffs too. But I think I can, and Damari Carroll has been playing a little bit better of late too. Norman Powell is a big defensive upgrade on Terrence Ross. Getting him out of the rotation, I think it can only help the defense as well. I mean, they really, if they don't play Valanciunas, the only bad defensive player that they have is DeRozan.
DeRozan plays a position where you can hide him. You know, like you can do that. And also, yeah, what makes the Raptors, this is also true of the Jazz, that makes them different from so many teams is that we talk about the idea of, oh, wow, they could look good if they played PJ Tucker and Serge Ibaka at the four and the five. And so the general follow-up to that is, oh, well, do they have enough wings to make that work? That's the issue with the Cavs, numerous other teams. But with the Raptors, the answer is yes. Damari Carroll, Norman Powell, DeMar DeRozan. You can even play Joseph and Lowry together, which they do sometimes, and that gives you a few minutes at the two. Like, they can make that happen. It's not perfect, but they can make it work.
Yeah, and Tucker can guard on the wing as well. You know, of course, we're critical of DeMar DeRozan. I think, you know, his points per game certainly overrates his impact, but he is important to what they do. And I realize that, you know, they'll get outscored a lot of times when he's on the floor and Lowry is off, and you might make you think, oh, he's not that valuable. But I mean, they can't score with him off the court, which is not a surprise now. I mean, they don't really have any other creators. You know, when he's been off the court since the trade, 96.3 offensive rating in 131 minutes. So he's still a pretty darn valuable player. You know, I think at least this year, certainly worth his contract. Does have those defensive limitations, the spacing limitations as well when he doesn't have the ball and can't spot up from three. But, you know, I mean, he's still creating shots at a league average efficiency, maybe a little bit above, is to the extent that he does, is still a very valuable skill. And especially with Lowry out, it looks pretty ugly offensively when he's not in there.
Are we ready to go to the last team?
So we are.
Washington Wizards, 41 and 26, 8-5 since the last 15-60, ninth in offense, 18th in defense, plus 2.3 net rating, 3% chance of getting the number one seed in the East, 5% title odds, and it's projected to finish third in the East, just ahead of the Raptors at 49 wins.
Yeah, that Dallas loss did not help their chances. I mean, I think earlier in the week, they were given like a 17% chance of the top seed, and the system certainly did not expect them to lose to Dallas. Scary foot sprain for John Wall in that game. He did return to start the second half, though. He's questionable right now against the Bulls. We'll see whether this is the type of thing that swells up on him and he has to miss time or not. But they gave up a 13-0 run to the Mavs late to lose that. That was definitely not what they wanted at home. How are they looking as far as their chances to get the second seed? Where are their projections in that respect with respect to Boston or and Toronto?
So they don't give odds there, but right now it's projected that Washington's going to end up with 49 wins, the Raptors with 48, but then the Celtics are all the way up at 53. I think they have a little bit of a softer schedule. And while Isaiah Thomas is actually going to miss their next two games, he's not traveling with the team due to a bone bruise, the Celtics are playing the Knicks and the Sixers, so they should be able to win both those games anyway.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see. The Knicks, I mean, those are both on the road, so you never know. We'll talk about some of their acquisitions. Brandon Jennings on the buyout market. Jan Mahimi has come back from injury. Kind of look at him as an acquisition. And then Bojan Bogdanović. Bojan has been fantastic. 19.5 PR, 69% true shooting, 23% usage, actually, which is a surprise that it's that high. So yeah, that's a pretty valuable offensive player for sure. He's not any good on defense, but he's shooting 46% on threes, taking 51% of his shots from threes and making them. They just needed somebody who could knock down some shots on that second unit. He likes to get out in transition, gets to the rim, finishes there as well. So he's not going to keep shooting that well on threes with this kind of volume, but I think it's clear that with some complementary talent around him, I mean, I think I saw a stat, I can't remember exactly what it was, but essentially he's taking a lot more of his shots as spot ups a lot more of his field goal attempts are potentially assisted, and a lot more of those are open, all of which you would expect with when he's playing with Wall, Beal. Even Brandon Jennings is a better point guard than he was playing with most of the time in Brooklyn.
It's a role that fits him very well. I mean, you don't expect that he'll shoot 46% on threes forever, but he can be an efficient offensive player there. And you brought up Jennings. Jennings is occupying a strange spot on this team because they're not only are they playing him with Wall, which is a little bit weird considering Jennings absolutely can't shoot right now. Wall is inconsistent, but Jennings is able to successfully pass the ball to open players. And that is something the Wizards did not have on their second unit before. So I think he's still helping their offense even when he can't shoot.
Yeah, he's actually averaging more assists per 100 possessions than John Wall is. But it's also possible that he just can't score anymore after the Achilles. I mean, his 21% from the field since he was acquired, I think it's been 7 games, 1 of 15 on threes, 7 of 31 overall. He's even 1 of 4 from the free throw line. So, that's going to get better, obviously. I think that he may be at the point now where you're not necessarily looking at him as a backup point guard solution, but he's still been a little bit better than Trey Burke, probably. He's at least steady. He's not going to screw up, that kind of stuff. It probably maybe needs to shoot even a little bit less than he has been. But to me, it's possible that Satoransky might be better than him. Satoransky is one of these guys who looks pretty crappy in the box score statistics and also can get blown by at times defensively. He'll have some really ugly one-on-one defensive possessions, but he's a smart player. He also is reliable, and they always seem to play pretty well with him on the floor if you look at the numbers. So while I think Jennings kind of just gets more credit because he has this NBA path, it's possible that Satoransky might be a little bit better than him. I mean, you're kind of splitting hairs at this level of player, but
an idea I wanted to delve into with them. Obviously, Bojan's going to, if they retain him, which I expect they will be a part of their rotation, but you could theoretically run a backcourt of Beal and Satoransky together. I think it's not perfect, but I think it can do, especially if you have Bojan shooting next to him. But the problem there is, do you really want to separate Wall and Beal, considering how much Wall and Beal help each other?
Yeah, and Satoransky can't shoot. I mean, that's the problem. That's why he's got to play. You can't really play him at the two. He's got to have the ball in his hands a little bit more. But he's still just kind of an effective player who knows how to play, and that seems to be counteracting some of his very clear limitations as far as shooting and one-on-one defense so far this year. But his minutes have certainly been intermittent. Jan Mahimi, we talked about earlier about that Wolves game. He looks like he's back physically. Defensively, he is impressed. I mean, he got lit up by Karl Towns, but he was playing about as good a defense as you could play on him most of the time. A solid rim protector. Meanwhile, Marcin Gortat has declined in one critical area. He's defended 561 shots at the rim, fifth in the NBA, because he was playing so many minutes before Mahimi came back, but allowing 57% shooting. That's a big drop. He's been around 50%, kind of around average, the last 3 years in that category. Mahimi has been one of the best rim protectors in the NBA and looks to be back at that level just subjectively. So, I mean, on most nights, are you going with Mahimi or are you going with Gortat to close out games?
Assuming the players were okay with it, I would actually kind of do it dependent on situation. So if you're ahead, I like Mahimi there because he's still developing a chemistry, which on Wall you wouldn't expect. I mean, Gortat and Wall are just amazing together. But if you need some points, you either go with Gortat or Markieff Morris there.
There is really no basis for this whatsoever. But I've always felt that when you're ahead, it's almost more important to keep scoring than to have a really good defensive unit out there. Because if you keep scoring, it doesn't matter what the offense does. And even if you put your best defensive guys out there, they can still just potentially get hot from three and score. Or if you're not scoring, then they can get out in transition or force turnovers, which is going to kill you getting back in transition defense. So I've always felt like having more offense out there when you have a lead is almost more important. And then when you're down, I think actually that getting stops is almost more important than scoring, for that same reason that the feedback loops that you always talk about. If you're going to make a comeback, if the other team's putting the ball in the basket, your task is already impossible. If you can block some shots, get some steals, force some misses, get out in transition, score quickly, I think that that's almost kind of more important. But I'm sure there's very little data to actually back that up. That's just kind of my personal feeling of, just if you think about all of the great comebacks in history, they're always fueled by great defense.
Well, I think it also depends on how far you're going to the extremes of like one-sided versus two-sided players. You know, like I think back to the idea of if you can't have somebody out there that the other team absolutely does not need to guard in those situations when you're behind. I agree, unless you're getting in transition, which is a good point. But
think about this, right? Memphis has been one of the best clutch teams forever, and they played Tony Allen, you know.
Well, and you could turn to Oklahoma City as well. I mean, Oklahoma City plays a lot of non-shooters, and they've been great in crunch time this year, too.
So I don't know. We lack the data to really come to any conclusions here. It's just a general feeling. It's something that's interesting to talk about.
Someone smart, write a Sloan paper on it.
A couple other small observations before we wrap up here. I think that having Markieff Morris has helped John Wall get a couple extra assists a game because twice a game will just go up to set a screen and then cut back door and get an alley-oop. And Wall has never really had anybody, especially among the bigs, who gets up for alley-oops the way Markieff Morris can. And Markieff's not amazing at that, but, you know, at least he can do it. Gortat's not a guy who was ever really going to just explode up off of 2 feet and get an alley-oop, even in his younger days. And then John Wall, you know, we talked about him being the best shot blocking point guard ever. I looked at the rim protection stats when I was looking at what Gortat was, and I was like, whoa, John Wall, 121 attempts defended this year, allows 48% shooting. That's awesome for a guard, you know, best shot blocking point guard ever. But then I went back and looked at the last 3 years. He was 61%, 52%, 58%. So a reminder that, and I think especially for perimeter players, it's going to be even more variable because it's just kind of luck of the draw, whether you're even around there to begin with. I think you're more likely to just kind of be in the area but not really defending that guy, and you just end up getting dinged by the system for that. And also, you're just talking about 100 attempts a year. That's really variable. Gortat, he had his over 500 attempts defended at the rim just this year. So I think a lot of context there for that, especially if you're looking at guys. You can say the stat and maybe it's worth talking about, but also there's so much variability if you're dealing with a small sample on that particular one that you don't want to go into. I still think that John Wall is the best shot blocking point guard ever, but, you know, I don't know that he's not like getting to the rim and doing verticality very often, you know, in the half court or something. A lot of it's more transition type of plays.
One other last note I wanted to make is that Otto Porter is still leading the NBA in 3-point shooting. He's at 45.4%. He's not blowing it away like he was a little bit early in the year, but 45.4 is still amazingly good.
Yeah, the big thing I think for him would be to increase his volume. That's something that's really next for him because he's become a better shooter, just stand still open, than we ever would have thought. But to just kind of speed up his release a little bit, I think would be the next step for him because he really is so accurate. I think if he's shooting that well, 45% on his current attempts, get a few more up there, fine. If your percentage drops to 40, that's quite okay if you're getting some more attempts up. All right, we done here?
Yeah, I'll mention that I put out the first part of my Real Jam Radio kind of going through the over-under podcast with Arturo Galletti. He and I, like Nate and I do, did that, and we went through and looked at where the teams are now, where we were right, where we were wrong. So the Eastern Conference part is out now. The Western Conference part might be out before the next Dunked On, depending on when we put that out. And then also for people who want something really, really different, my sister is a biologist, and she and I do a mascot bracket every year. So basically, she knows nothing. She knows very little about sports, and we just do. I give her the mascot. She knows nothing, and she just says who would win in a fight. We do the whole thing. It's ludicrously fun.
Is anyone here a marine biologist?
Yeah, somebody made that joke on Twitter like yesterday, and I really wanted to respond to it. No, I'll save it. But yeah, my sister's a marine biologist. I don't think she's ever seen that episode either. Seinfeld. Maybe we should give her a Seinfeld's on CISO, right?
No, they're on Seinfeld's on.
Okay,
but yeah, Seinfeld is awesome. That's one of my favorite episodes for sure. All right, thanks for listening. Also, thanks to everyone who watched the Twitter NBA show Second Screen yesterday. Probably gonna do one on Sunday. I forget what the game is. Gonna be traveling, but I think we've got like this mobile rig now, so that'll be fun to do. At least do like the second half or something. If you watch that, really appreciate anyone who wants to give me some feedback on how to improve it on Twitter. This has been really something that we're starting and trying to look for ways to improve it, make it more useful, but had some nice comments on it so far, which we appreciate, but also want to know how to get better. Don't forget about our sponsors today as well. SeatGeek, the cap space code, will get you $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase via rebate. Talk to you all next time. Thank you so much to Coca-Cola and Powerade for sponsoring today's program. You can get tons of helpful tips on your NCAA March Madness bracket this year at coke.com/alwaysready. Grab a 6-pack of Coca-Cola and an 8-pack of Powerade for tonight's tip-off and gear up for all the games by picking up Coca-Cola and Powerade at Walmart. Get in on the March Madness action by visiting coke.com/alwaysready.